So hi, my name is Angelique Pesci, and my favorite thing is reading.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the podcast where we get recommendations without using an algorithm. This morning, I am joined by author Angelique Pesci. Her book, American Pastime, is coming out on June 7th, 2022. So you can pre-order it now. It will be available this summer. And her next book is already in the works as well. Angelique, how are you doing this morning?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be talking to you today about these novels and American Pastime in particular.
I'm so happy to have you here and to get to know you. Where are you based these days?
So right now I'm up in Connecticut by Stamford.
Nice.
Which is nice. I'm a born and raised New Yorker, though.
Okay.
So I've been in New York my whole life, and then I've been up in Connecticut now for a couple of years, which has been really good for my writing, believe it or not.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Without the competition of all that New York has to offer.
Yep, exactly. New York is a great place, but there's so much to do, even if you're just going out to get a snack. And Connecticut is incredibly pastoral. So I'm by a little river called the 5 Mile River. It has like a little brook that goes all the way from like northern Connecticut all the way down into, I think, the Rye area. Like it goes into the Atlantic Ocean eventually and empties out somewhere in Rye. And then I'm like this little waterfall and this little walking bridge. And I mean, there's really no better place to write. So.
Oh, that sounds beautiful.
It is. It's really, really, really nice. Although writing in New York was great. I'd wear my headphones and mm-hmm. I'd have my laptop and I would just tune it out. But I would definitely always write in a coffee shop. And there's
right.
no better coffee shops in the world than New York, I think. Well, maybe in Rome.
Right. That's fair. That's fair. But then in Rome, you have to pay the extra cost of, I went truly for 24 hours. But if I remember correctly, there's a difference between the sit down price and the standing price.
True.
In Rome.
True. Yes, that's very true. I forgot about that. That's really funny.
Yeah.
There are differences. Yeah. Like that I completely forget.
Yeah. Like if you're going to a wine bar before dinner or if you're having a coffee, it's like, well, are you going to sit or are you going to stand? It's not to go. It's like sitting and standing.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder what Americans would say if we tried to do something like that here.
I don't think it would go well.
Probably not.
But if it came with paying a living wage to the waiters... Because that's kind of it, right? Like you're paying an extra fee to sit because you're going to need the waiters. You're going to need wait staff.
True.
That is my assumption.
True.
You're not just paying rent on the table.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. Correct. Correct. Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah. So tell me, we were chatting a little bit before I hit record. American Pastime is a novel. And why don't you tell me a little bit about it?
Sure. So the main protagonist in American Pastime is a writer. He's also a builder. Mm-hmm. And he decides one day while sitting at a baseball game at Yankee Stadium to reflect on his life because he sees the players rounding the bases. And it reminds him of his own childhood and when he was a baseball player as a kid. And so as they're rounding the bases, it uses the analogy of life is a game and the bases of life are first, second, third base before you get home and pass on into the nether regions of our next existence. And so he goes through flashbacks in the novel of his childhood, then his adulthood, mm-hmm. ultimately he projects, because he's only in his 30s, late 30s, so he projects into his future and imagines his senior years mm-hmm. and what that might look like. And during this plot line, You know, there's arcs, like any story has arcs,
yeah,
you know, built into it. Act one, two, and three. But during those various acts in the book, he's joined by an omniscient being who he calls God, who decides to personify and sit with him at the game and have a talk about life, about mm-hmm. American life, about American culture, about COVID, about high school shootings, about politics, mm-hmm. about science, about what we're going to build in our future. And all of that reflection allows for him to go through his life change before it's too late. So if you had to live your life all over again, how would yeah. you live it? If you had that crystal ball to see what your finale would look like, would it be the same? Mm-hmm. The book really does internalize all of those questions for its audience. Kind of gives you a couple of exercises as well about how to handle those issues when you have to make huge life sweeping decisions, which, yeah. you know, as Americans, and we have huge sweeping decisions yeah. to make all of the time, whether to work remotely, you know, whether to become an artist, whether to be, you know, a corporate employee only, whether to be a farmer, you mm-hmm. know, whether to live a more sustainable life. I mean, mm-hmm. these are the questions that we're faced with. And those questions persist even through, you know, tragedies like COVID and how we stick together after September 11th and, you know, all of these overriding issues that make your own tiny speck of dust that you are seem so infinitesimal, but you're so important mm-hmm. in the large scheme of things as part of a team. And so we're back to the analogy of sports.
Yeah.
You're all a part of a team and you're all a part of a world team. And so the book really does get the reader to think that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was the first kernel, as you started down the path of writing this book, as you headed to the ballpark of this yep. manuscript, are you a lifelong baseball fan or did you have kind of an epiphany at a park? Like, how did this analogy and setting come to you?
I'm an athlete. I'm an avid athlete. I've had a lot of friends over the years who've talked about baseball and the innings in baseball and how it's not like basketball or anything mm-hmm. else, a game that technically doesn't have to end. There's no time clock
right.
In the game. And so that became kind of like a mantra in my mind. Mm-hmm. I don't play baseball. I did play softball.
Yeah,
I was really good at running bases. I was terrible at hitting the ball. Terrible.
And hitting the ball is what gets you to the bases. So they yeah. can yeah.
I can't tell you how many I had a punt. You know, mm-hmm. like after the sixth ball, it was they just let me punt and run. But I was really good at guarding my bases, and I was really good. Back then you were allowed to steal bases. You're not allowed to do that anymore. Mm. But I would help my middle school win yeah. games that way because of my bad batting.
Yeah. You know,
I had to make up for it with my strong legs. But I was a really good runner. So I was better at soccer. But this was the right vehicle because I needed, I really did need something that went through the stages of life that right. was also a sport. I really wanted that team-oriented, hard work ethic mm-hmm. and reflection to come through in the story and in the stages of baseball and in, you know, first, second, third base and home. We use it all the time.
Absolutely.
We do. We even use it, you know, as kids, you know, growing up. I'm on the first base of my life, you know, and so the analogy just seemed really appropriate for the athlete in me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. And you mentioned COVID. So was this a COVID primarily COVID writing project for you?
Actually, this novel started being written well before COVID.
Okay.
It was originally a screenplay that was being produced and it was picking up some tread. And then I decided to expand the plot line because there were a lot of issues with regard to American culture and life. And I studied theology, ethics, and law and art. So okay. I wanted a vehicle that permitted me to be able to write a story about American pop culture, and about the game of life, and about having great conversations with each other. So I decided to turn this book into a novel, and I'm so glad that I did. This novel started in 2019, so well before COVID.
Yeah.
But because it handled a lot of issues like gender bias or racism, the history that we've inherited of oddities, transgender, issues that students and adults really need your support, a loving, kind, scientific community. Mm-hmm. It hit all of these issues, even our great tragedies like September 11th. And what does it mean to be in the legislature during a time like that? And how does the politic help, you know, improve the country? And how do you help improve, you know, the ethics of our leaders?
Right.
By being involved in our American culture, and how important are our conversations with one another when spreading, you know, that kind of support that adults need, young adults need, seniors, they need support in the later stages of their life as well. So the book really, you know, hones in on that. And so when COVID came up, it got added in an edit, you know, about, you know, briefly about what, you know, that kind of communication tool gives you. Facebook, Twitter, podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, these are our communication tools. They shouldn't alienate us. We shouldn't get made fun of for looking, you know, at our device. We should see it, that there's a human on the other side of those devices.
Yeah.
And our ethics should persist through that. You know, I teach mass media law ethics and mass media communications law. And our legislatures are constantly dealing with bullying on the internet. Mm-hmm. And then there's the high school shooting, you know, and the mass shootings on the high school campuses. And our kids need support. You know, they need to know that we don't envision a future where their school is, you know, the next war zone. You know, we're going to build a future that's going to protect them. We're going to build a future that's going to thrive. And we pull together, and COVID's an amazing example of that. You know, we pull together through that. We definitely have a healthy economy, and we care a lot, Leah, about our economy, mm-hmm. but we were all willing to use the devices that are talked about in my book to make a safer place for ourselves. And we put humanity first and work remotely. And it's so important that as I was writing that book in 2019 and then had it slated for publication, that was in 2020 or 2021, and they held it back. It was amazing to see what I was talking about with regard to using the internet more appropriately, mm-hmm. to not bully each other over it, or use it as a means of distancing ourselves from humanity, but getting into the electronics as a way of communication, conversation, increasing it. And then lo and behold, everything that I said came to pass. You know, everybody was really connected thanks to, you know, the internet highway and being able to see the devices as our way of staying close to humanity. And it's necessary. You know, we're going to go the next century, and the inventions that we build and make and how we learn to have communication and humanity when those changes come is of high importance. And that's really what the team effort is, you know, with the game of life and the game of baseball, and how we go through all of those bases together as a country.
Wonderful. You've mentioned working remotely a couple times. Did you have to take your classes, your media law, mass media and communications classes online as well?
I would have had to, but I went into sabbatical
right
before COVID, because we were working in conjunction with a law school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to to discuss whether or not I was going to take sabbatical. That this was at Manhattan College, one of the greatest colleges.
Yeah.
Also why the book is set at Yankee Stadium, because I was a volunteer at Highbridge Community Center. I worked in the Highbridge community a long time as a former NYU and former Manhattan College graduate. And okay. So there is a mess for being pro Yankees. It's the stadium's right down the block. So it's like a huge part of my personal history. But yes, I've been on sabbatical, and I wrote two children's books. I have another book called Yemen Love Story coming out, which is about falling in love under the burqa.
Mm-hmm.
It's awesome. It's going to be so interesting to see how the audience feels about life and communication from under an entire garment where you can, you know, only use your words,
right,
to build that rapport and that relationship. And I had summered while a law student. I was a St. John's University School of Law graduate, and I summered there at the United Nations Division for the Advancement of Women.
Okay.
While I was a student there, and I was in the war crimes unit. And so I decided to get this other idea for this book about a woman falling in love under the burqa based on my work down there. And I've mm-hmm. been teetering with that and writing that here and there for the last couple of years. And it's finally coming together. So that's really exciting too. But yes, to answer your question, because of writing and work, and I have a law firm, and I'm a costume designer, and I'm a mom, which is the most important job that I have in the whole world. I did take sabbatical, but I'm sure I'll go back one
yeah.
day. I'll go back probably in a year.
Yeah. That'll be
it.
Great.
I miss it. A lot of my lecture material ended up in American Pastime too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. All of the communication ethics issues and concerns and how we talk to one another and treat each other, that all ended up in the Eastern Western philosophies of how we handle each other in humanity. A lot of the good lectures ended up kind of in the book.
Ooh, that's neat.
Yeah.
That's such a great device of being able to turn what you've been lecturing on and what you've been teaching people into like a more, like, one, people don't have to get into law school to hear what you have to say.
Absolutely.
But what a great way to translate those lectures into something for the masses. That's outstanding. I look forward to reading it.
Thank you.
Now you mentioned that you're a costume designer and you have already we've heard of the things that you do in your life and quite a varied life. But one of the favorite things you suggested we talk about is science fiction. And specifically, we were going to start with Dune because you do costumes and Jacqueline, her last name escapes me, the costume designer, got incredible recognition. But you are a lover of science fiction.
I am. I think I like science fiction and Dune in particular. I was amazed this year and thrilled that a sci-fi feature was being so honored at the Oscars. And I know Coda won Best Picture, and I still have to see it. And I heard a lot of great things. I actually have coworkers who worked on Coda, believe it or not, in the production department. I'm really wow. proud of them. But Dune, I just thought, did such a splendid job. And I like sci-fi for the same reason that I'm always forward and foreseeable and negligence oriented thinking. I'm always wondering, what are the improvements we can make? What's wrong in our way of functioning that we can improve? I like to make things that are wrong right, but things that are right function better.
Mm-hmm.
It could be because I organize wardrobe all of the time as a designer, that I
right.
have that in my background. My grandmother owned a bridal salon and was a designer herself. And so I grew up really organized. And then on my dad, he owned a pastry shop, and that takes a lot of organization.
Yeah.
So I grew up around two incredible matriarch and patriarch that just always was organizing the day and It's a lot like King Richard. I don't know if you've seen it yet. The Venus of Serena Williams. It's so great. And in it, he asks his kids, like, what did you write in your daily planner to organize your day? Mm-hmm. And I was like, bravo. You know, that's the right way to be as a parent. So I like sci-fi a lot, because you have all of this creative freedom, you know, there's no parameter. And you can suggest really great inventions, like 10,000 Leagues Under the Sea, you know, suggested the submarine. And I think that it's a good vehicle. Sci-fi is a great vehicle to do that. And then there's, you know, like Ruth Carter's like an incredible costume designer, and she got to show, you know, different ideas and cultures and textures and ethics in Black Panther, in our country, you know, in American comics. And I think it's really, you know, important to have that growth. When you do period pieces as a designer, or you're in the period piece genre instead of sci-fi, you have all of the history to stick to. So it's really very strict, like law, you know, it's like a very strict place to be. So I love sci-fi for that reason. And Dune was great. And I think that the director, if I pronounce his name properly, Villeneuve, he did an incredible job.
Yeah. When you think about watching science fiction through your life, was there a first movie or first science fiction book that really stands out to you as starting you down the path of this genre?
I think The Time Machine by Wells.
Okay.
Thing that I loved as a kid. I remember, I think it was Una was her name, the main actress in it, who, you know, was educating the time traveler about all the Morlocks being underground, and, you know, how their society looked ideal, but under the surface something was going on. Mm-hmm. And I just found that to be fascinating. I thought the physics of it was fascinating. I thought, you know, the morality play within the novel was fascinating.
Yeah.
And it really opened me up as a reader and a writer.
Okay. Is there a science fiction book that you've read that hasn't been made into a movie that gets Angelique Pesce thinking, if I would adapt this, if I could be the director or the costume designer, is there a book that's kind of on your dream list?
That's a good question. I would have said Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
As far as an action science fiction piece, but that got made over the last, 4 or 5 years. So I know there was the TV show while I was a kid.
Yes.
But that was the one I waited forever to see finally made. And I was a literary major too. I was a double major. So I have an English literary major. So your question is really good. Other than that actually coming to fruition, I believe that for me, it probably comes through my English major. There's a book called Perfume that I have often, it's not sci-fi though. He's a little sci-fi. But it is set in the past, but he has attributes or qualities that are kind of like a science fiction character. Because he smells people's oils and he smells the perfume on them, is what he says. But he's a very dark, dark character. So that's kind of like a Jekyll Hyde kind of sci-fi.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's something over the years that I, as a book reader and who I read that book, it's something that I would like to have seen do in a modern or futuristic context.
Yeah,
not so much in the past, but his attributes are really quite
I've never read that book. I'll look it up. I'll link to these in the show notes so that people can find things and be able to read them. And where along the path, because you're a lawyer, an author, you've studied so many things, where along the path did costume design get folded in?
Good question. So I was working as a managing attorney of a New York City law firm.
Okay.
The law firm owner's name is David Sheinfeld, and he was an incredible Harvard law graduate. He had owned this law firm in Midtown Manhattan for 40 years when I arrived. It was federal law, immigration practice, and also state and federal litigation and entertainment. Mm-hmm. And some real estate and some criminal. So it was almost general practice, but it had like this a lot of different areas of law that it focused on, but it was heavy into litigation. So I had been promoted into managing attorney, I think after 5 years at the law firm. Mm-hmm. And then we wound down the practice because the owner had passed on. And he was a rabbi as well as a lawyer. And he actually went to Harvard Law School with Clive Davis. So he's the most incredible boss I could have ever had.
Wow.
And I miss him dearly. And so it still exists. The sons took over and decided to parcel the law firm out to, based on my suggestions, out to two large Manhattan law firms. And I ended up going to London for a little soul searching.
Okay.
And I was so exhausted. I just was so burnt out and I was so tired.
Mm-hmm.
And I just decided to see how to tap in to becoming either my own law firm owner, my own film producer, because I had production coordinated a film and worked for a production company back in 2000 to 2001. Okay. And I had kind of wanted to go back to that because I did some assisting and second unit producing to a producer. And I learned a lot about filmmaking and I had wanted to use my law degree for that and for that purpose. So all of a sudden, when I'm back from London, mm-hmm. and I start working for a production company, making a film, I start out as an assistant to the production coordinator, thinking that that's really a good way for me to use my law degree and my film and my education and my background. And then all of the sudden, I look up one day to the head producer and I say, can I just work in the wardrobe department on this one instead? Because I'm just so tired of paperwork all day.
Uh-huh.
I grew up in the bridal salon with my grandmother and the costume designer kept coming in on the film and asking me for help with, you know, getting products from Ann Taylor or getting products from Dick's Sporting Goods. And so I ended up out of the office in the stores, pulling the garments for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so we became so close that I said, I could really use like a new career.
Yeah.
I could really use a change of pace. So I can always produce, right? I'm my own producer in that regard. And I have a documentary I'm producing right now called The God Doc, being directed by Olenka Denisenko, who just directed an episode on New Amsterdam. So
wow.
We've known each other for years. And she's a really talented director. So I'm really happy that she signed on. So I just decided to go back to the other side of my family, my grandmother's side of the family, and just kind of just enjoy the hard work that
uh-huh.
comes with clothes. And clothes are such hard work, you
yeah.
know, but they're not paper. They're on people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wanted, and I love writing. So I love paper, but I just think that I needed to free my mind a little, dive into something I did as a child. I sewed as a child. I beaded as a child. I sketched as a child. I helped my grandma design clothes as a child that I just missed her. And she was getting on in years. And this was right before she passed away. And I kind of have this feeling that I felt her with me more every second while that transition was going on. And I was missing her already. And so I think what happened was all that hard work at the law firm before it was sold. And then that soul searching in London and then coming back to New York and diving into the career of film. I really did honor that as a producer, you should be able to do all of the departments. And
right.
so I have so much respect for production designers, lighting departments, screenwriters, costume designers that I decided to just kind of, and cinematographers that I just decided to jump into something where I had a familial background in it. And then I never stopped. So as much as I produce and as much as I write, I also costume design, have my own law firm. And it's really worked out. And it's because of my grandma that happened. And it always gives me that extra step in creativity that takes us to like a sculpture, like you're the sculptor, you know, and that's really special because as much as I can write a script or produce a document, this is such a humane area and, you know, and department in filmmaking that it just came really naturally to me, thanks to her. And her name was Venera, Venus, actually, Venera Rica. And so I continue in her footsteps to keep that part of our family tree alive.
Oh, yeah. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
How do you balance? You do so much. Like, how are you
talking to nice people like you? you give me balance.
Oh.
Yep.
Do you have some, do things come in waves? Like, you're kind of like, this quarter is like more about costumes and this quarter is more about law, or is it sort of juggling, the costume design and the law firm and the family and the writing all at the same time?
Well, the good news is I'm a project person. So the law firm, you know, is something that has been open for, you know, a while now. And there's a partner that I have who runs it.
Okay.
So I usually handle stuff like that as it arises, you know, but the bulk of my day is spent as a legal consultant, helping, you know, law firms and agencies where they need aid and help. And then I have the law practice run with a partner. And then the film, it does all happen at the same time. I mean, I definitely have the law slated every day from like 7 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Okay.
And then I have from like 4 p.m. to like 9 or 10, I have costume work. Like, I just designed a play and they do tech runs in the evening.
Right.
So there's no work to be done during the day, you know, on those projects.
Yeah.
And then sometimes my partner will let me go and like, I won't have a consulting client and then I won't have as much work to be performed during a work day. So I can do a film instead, because films are typically slated during the day, like a work day. So it depends on who's hiring me and where I am and why I'm there, you know? Yeah.
That's great. So it sounds like you found a lot of flexibility in the people that you're working with, the people that you've chosen to make, your businesses with.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's been good. It's been this way since 2009. So I can't really complain.
Yeah.
Been a long time now.
And now that you're in Connecticut, do you have to go in to New York for like film work and plays, or are things shooting locally?
Well, there are things shooting locally. So, and I am a member of the guild. And a lot of people, when they hire designers, believe it or not, designers don't necessarily go to set. It depends on what kind of designer you are. I've been around a really long time. So most of the directors have liked to work with me before they shoot at all. And before they've even cast.
Okay.
And so they like to have like evening meetings, sketches, photographs of ideas, mood boards. And then you send that off to them. Then they cast and you do your fittings like at a hotel once the cast flies in. And so that usually takes, and you have shoppers. So like you hire your shopper. And then all of your visual ideas, it's almost like being a writer, right? So all of your visual ideas are sent to your shopper. And then you have a supervisor who goes to set for you.
Okay.
And they pack and they put the truck together and everything is pre-selected by the director. And it's a budget savvy department. So you make sure you're within your budget boundaries, you're not over budget. And then you have all of the actors and the garments on set working and everything slated in advance, like at a library, all the books are slated and coded.
Yeah.
All of the looks are coded in advance. So the designer does not have to go to set. Although you can be working while it's shooting. It depends. Like right now I tend only to take projects where I don't necessarily have to go to the set,
right,
and I can hire the shopper and the supervisor and a set costumer, and they'll do that work on location. And they'll just send me everything via email, text, telephone, Zoom, and stuff like that. But then there's some projects that are just handled differently, and I'm on set the whole time. So it depends.
That's so interesting.
It depends. Yeah. Yeah.
Huh.
So I've done both, you know.
Yeah.
I just costume designed a piece called King of Queens out in Hoboken, New Jersey. And the whole thing was done remotely. And then an assistant took all of the costumes to set. So.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm curious, is that something that pre-COVID, were you allowed to work so remotely as a wardrobe, as a designer and a costume designer in that way?
Yes, you're technically all productions are shot from what's called are organized from what's called a production office.
Okay.
And so the production office is a new rental usually. It's not something that's already in existence. It's like you start up the corporation that's shooting the film. It rents an office for a specific period of time, 4 months, 3 months, whatever it is in the pre-production. Sometimes it's a year, 2 years. It depends, yeah, you know, on the feature that you're shooting. But the less bodies in there, the better until
sure.
Fitting. until the actors arrive. And that's when, you know, so you can have the clothes shopped for and sent there. And you could still be sourcing and contacting distributors, designers, you know, or just drawing and coloring and sketching your ideas out and discussing yeah. them by meeting. And then once the people arrive, then you really go to the office and start to show them the fitting photos and meet the actors and try on the clothes and decide what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so interesting.
It's fun. It's a fun thing.
Yeah.
And it's a lot like writing books. So it is a lot like that too.
Yeah.
Very creative. It's a very creative part of work.
Yeah. Now we went pretty far away from science fiction, which is fine. This has all been so fascinating, because it's, you know, how movies get made, how shows get made is so opaque to people
sure.
who aren't in the industry. But I'm gonna take us back to Dune. Did you see it? Did you watch it on TV, or did you go into the theater to see it?
No, I went to a bow tie cinema to see it on the big screen.
Yeah.
It was phenomenal. But I did get a screener because I'm in the union too. But I when it's big, 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 big production, I typically like to dip into the theater. And I took my sons as well. I thought it was going to be a fairly unique film to watch on. And they liked it a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, it was one of the first movies I saw back. And I actually went and saw it in the theater twice. Because
yeah,
I hadn't read the book. I hadn't seen the David Lynch version of it. So I enjoyed it much more the second time because I finally understood. I understood the story a little bit more. I had read more about it. And I could take it in at a different level.
Yes. And the, you know, production design, you know, the whole schematic of the spice and the agriculture in this piece, you know, to have the background be, you know, yards and yards and yards of the sand and the dunes mm-hmm. was so breathtaking and so such a grand accomplishment
yeah.
to to make that look interesting for 2.5 hours.
Right.
I mean, so much footage of sand that the designers and the actors and the cinematographer and the score, which I believe was done by Hans Zimmer, was incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he also won the Oscar for best score.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you have favorite, when you watch movies, do costumes stand out to you? Like, was there a character that you thought was your favorite, or an environment, the way they were dressed, that really caught your attention?
Yes, I really liked Colleen Atwood's work over the years. Mm-hmm. I liked Edward Scissorhands when I was, I believe I was in high school or college, I forget. But I remember that being so creative and so fascinating to me. And that's like one of those movies that's fantasy sci-fi, but also more period than one would expect.
Right.
I like those very large productions, Gangs of New York, phenomenal, mm-hmm. you know, where everything is built head to toe and really gets your creative eye to be fed, you know?
Yeah.
And so for me, there's movies where the fabrics and the textures and the designs, you know, they just don't stop. Baz Luhrmann, and mm-hmm. I know his wife is his costume and production designer. I mean, Romeo and Juliet, Moulin Rouge.
Stunning, you know, both of them.
The Gatsby. Yeah, and whether they're set in contemporary times or in the past or kind of a collage of all of those things, you know, it just, it makes sense to me. It's how I see things too. So for me, I know they're the best designers, but they're inspiring designers.
Yeah, I think Greg Gatsby's it's such a good example because it is it's a period piece, but it's elevated.
Exactly.
Right. It's not true. It's not true to the period. It's definitely inspired by the 20s, but then it is kind of the musical, just elevated version of that, cranked up, dialed up to 11.
Yes, absolutely. There's a creative, you know, internal space that is projected externally in the screenplay, in the piece itself on film. And that's, I mean, you know, you'd have to speak to the filmmaker directly, not just me as an audience and craft person, but I see a lot of an extra element added to the pieces of work that go to the externalization of what the characters are going through.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what gives you that extra element of fantasy and takes you out of it just being a decade or a period piece and allows for that collage of music and cinematography and over the top fashions that exaggerate what the film is actually about, you know, or the period the film is actually, you know, told from. And I talk about Gatsby and I talk about F. Scott Fitzgerald in American Pastime, believe it. And to, you know, the whole American society and the whole different wealth classes and what the periods go through internally and externally and how that affects the country.
Yeah.
It's fully written into American Pastime, the novel as well.
Wow.
Scott Fitzgerald was a poignant author. And I think that Baz Luhrmann, the Australian director, did an amazing job capturing a piece of American, iconic American history in that film. Yeah.
I think I'm due for a rewatch. I feel like I saw it in the theater. It was just so beautiful. It was so beautiful. It was so, it was such an I remember it being just an immersive experience because it was so, the way it was, the camera direction, some of the party scenes, the single shots, I don't know the words for it, but like where they're taking you down and in and through. So it was such, I remember it being very immersive and very high energy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it could be a dolly shot or it could be a crane shot. I'm not sure.
Right.
But there's a lot of devices that they use for the sweeping emotive, you know,
yeah.
The evocative entrances and exits in and out of those lush parties,
mm-hmm.
And the champagne fountain,
right.
You know, overflowing, and the absolute opulent luxury of it all.
Yeah.
And then suppose against, you know, the dirt road that runs through town with the billboard, with the glasses on mm-hmm. the billboard, at everybody. It's an incredible American tale. It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, great. Angelique, is there anything about science fiction, costume design, American pastime, or writing that I haven't gotten to ask you about that if we hung up, you'd be so bummed I didn't ask you?
No, not at all. Not at all. It's been a pleasure. Your questions, you made me feel complete, really, that I've had the opportunity to write a piece about American culture, American pop culture, American families,
yeah.
American art, sports, life, and conversation. You really, you hit all of the points of the book really on the head at this point.
I look forward to reading it. Like I said, it feels like it could either be a whole encyclopedia. I'm excited to see how you've distilled it into a novel that is not 5,000 pages long.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, I know. And I can't wait for you to read it. And I want you to privately write me at my email address and give me your reviews. I hope that in words, in the textile that we have, thanks to trees on our page.
Yes.
And the ink on the page. I hope in that language textile, it gives us a little bit of what Annie Leibovitz gives us with her photography.
Mm-hmm.
I really tried very hard to use language and language arts in writing yeah. this, to be creative about it.
Yeah.
Not as creative as, let's say, there's the author who plays with language a lot, whose name escapes me right now, where his novels are written in a vernacular that was almost brand new and made up. But so not in his shadow, but more in the vein of our ability to use language and
yeah.
to communicate so that we can get along and create a better future of peace by using our words and our textile on the page and our computers in a way that really brings our teamwork together and being a part of a nation together.
Beautiful.
Yeah. And with what's going on in the Ukraine and Russia, I think that this book, it has a lot of peacekeeping studies and a lot of peace-minded negotiations and diplomacy ideas and
yeah.
using language properly and not bullying each other and supporting all of those scientific parts of being 99.9% exactly the same in the world, you know, in our DNA composition
mm-hmm.
and what makes us different. And our 0.01 differences is just aesthetics, like a dress, nothing else.
Right.
It's got no value except self-expression. And I think that's a good thing, you know, to see each other that way is a good thing. So I hope you like the book, Leah. Everybody likes the book.
Thank you.
If you have any questions while you're reading it, you're more than welcome to email me and ask. I hope that I'll see you again and that this isn't the only time that we have a podcast together.
Yes.
Yeah.
Are you on social media? Do you want people to follow you online?
Oh yeah, I'm on Twitter. My Facebook page is public, so you can also friend me on that.
Okay.
I'm on LinkedIn right now.
Great.
I'm sure I'll get more. I was on TikTok. I don't know what happened. I had the funniest videos of me on TikTok and my kids, and like my account got, I don't know what happened. It just disappeared on me one day.
Yeah. I accidentally logged out of my TikTok, and then in
yeah.
order to just like set a new password, I then created like 5 more TikTok accounts, and I was like, what is happening? I just want to log into the one I have. And
yes.
I truly accidentally created, I get alerts in my email like, Leah Jones 32525, like, we think you'll like these videos. And I'm like, that account was an accident. So I don't know. It is the weird. I love TikTok. I hate how much I love it.
Yeah, it is the funniest. Yeah, I'm a big fan.
But yeah, I have absolutely accidentally created. It seems so easy to lose accounts. So great. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.